Chapter 26, The Floating Island. Hal raised his gun. He lowered it again. The range was too great. Besides, he remembered that he had only one cartridge left. That one had Croc's name on it. Somehow, he would catch up with that devil and bore a hole clear through his evil carcass. As he calmed down, he realised that his chances of ever seeing Croc again were slim. He laid Roger on the sand and began to take stock of the situation. He had no boat. He had no tools to make one. He had his hunting knife and, given a week, he might whittle out a raft. He was given not a week, but only minutes. An hour or so at the most. The scout might not have had to go all the way back to his village to contact his band. The Indians had been hunting Croc and might be very nearby. He and Roger might hide in the jungle, but they had none of the things they would need. He had stowed everything on the ark in preparation for sailing, even the pans he had used to get breakfast on board. He took an inventory. Between them, they had two shirts, two pairs of trousers, two pairs of alpargata sandals, two hammocks, one knife, one gun with one bullet, and that one bullet was reserved. Nor was the jungle a good hiding place from Indians. The enraged Indians scouring the forest in search of Croc would find them sooner or later. And the greatest objection to hiding out in the woods was that it would not bring him any closer to Croc. As he watched the black speck of the ark disappearing down the river, it seemed futile to hope to bring Croc to a reckoning, or to recover his collection. That was the worst of it, losing the animals. That meant failure for his father's business, and victory for Shark Sands and his henchmen. It meant, too, that Hal would not get a chance to go to the South Seas, the reward that had been offered by his father for success in the Amazon Enterprise. But he was not ready to give up yet. His roving eye lit upon a floating island passing the mouth of the bay. A wild thought came to him. He did not stop to analyse it. There was no time to weigh chances. He lifted Roger and made his way to the end of the point. The river was browner, more turbid, and more rapid than usual. The main current boiled past close to the point. Something colossal must be going on in the headwaters of the flanks of the Andes. The swollen river was dotted with moving islands. They were of different kinds, although due to the same cause, flood. One that passed very close was a kind that he did not care to trust. A bed of water hyacinths torn loose from some marsh. Only the leaves and flowers showed above the surface. Below, the bulbs must be tangled together in a tightly knit mass. But the whole mat was not more than a foot thick and might not support two husky boys. Even if it did, one of those great floating trees with branches milling around like paddle wheels and roots projecting like the tentacles of an octopus might roll over the islet, destroying it and everyone who happened to be on it. Many boats, even large steamers, had been stoved in by those crazily thrashing trees. Then there were islands made up of brush. In some rapids, a bush had caught on a rock. Other bushes, sticks and logs had jammed it, and the whole had been matted firmly in one solid mass and had finally broken loose to sail downstream as an island. An island without soil. But more amazing were the islands that had soil, plants, even trees. Everything an island should have, except the ability to stay in one place. A strong current had undercut a piece of land. A strong current had undercut a piece of land and carried it off entire. Some of these islands were 200 feet across. He had heard that they were at times 20 feet thick. But Hal could not wait for the ideal island. He must take the first reasonable chance that came along. He explained his purpose to Roger, who only half understood what it was all about. Something that looked like a large pasture came floating by, and when it grazed the point, Hal stepped aboard with his burden. He was thankful that he did not immediately sink through into the river. In a moment, the point was left behind. The two boys were embarked upon as strange a voyage as anyone had ever made. Perhaps it had been a crazy idea, But anything was better, Hal told himself, than sitting on shore waiting to be beheaded. Now they were leaving behind those eternally thumping, nerve-wearing drums, and he was on the trail of Croc. True, Croc could go faster with sail than he could on a floating island, but suppose the wind dropped or veered to blow upstream. Suppose Croc got caught on a sandbar or on a sunken log. Lots of things might happen to delay him. Hal considered that he had a fighting chance. He surveyed his floating kingdom. He laid Roger down in the grass and walked about, frequently testing the ground to be sure that it was strong enough to hold him. His island was a good half acre in size. Much of it was in grass, but there were also many small trees, especially cecropias, rubber trees, and bamboos. The fast-growing bamboo was tall, but all the other trees were not more than a few feet high. Hal's active mind went to work on this curious fact, and he came out with what he believed to be the answer. His island was quite evidently only a year old. The flood of a year ago had deposited a half acre of silt somewhere, and when the water subsided, there was a new island. Seeds sprouted and trees attained a year's growth, and now comes this year's flood to undercut the island, lift it from its firm base and carry it off bodily downriver. The only trouble with this theory was the fact that on the downstream side of the island lay an enormous tree that must have taken 100 years to grow. He walked over to examine it. It was a great silk cotton or kapok tree. Its trunk lay in the water, and its huge branches rose some 50 feet into the air. At the base of the trunk was a tangle of big roots. No, his theory still held water. This tree was not a part of the island. The two had merely become jammed together while floating downriver. But he could use the fallen giant to good advantage. He strung up the hammocks between the branches, then brought Roger and laid him in his hammock, where he could not be in danger from snakes or army ants, or any other wildlife that might be on this little floating world. Which reminded him that he must feed his patient and himself. That was a sobering thought. Many an adventurer in the Amazon forests had died of hunger, even though he had the entire jungle to draw upon. Hal had only the resources of a half acre. Robinson Crusoe had had much more to work with. Hal spent the rest of the day having bright ideas that didn't work out. He looked among the bamboo for shoots, but there were none enough to be edible. He tried the berries on a bush, only to make himself sick. He saw a little tree which he believed to be the famous cow tree, which, when slashed, gives forth a very good substitute for cow's milk. He slashed this one, but it was too small, only a few white drops exuded. This was proving more of a job than he had expected. Once he had read the Fighting Forces handbook, Survival, and had derived from it the idea that survival, whether in the jungle, in the Arctic, in the desert or at sea, was really a simple matter. Did not appear so simple now. But there must be plenty of fish in the river. He had no line, but he would catch them as the Indians did. He spent 2 hours fashioning a wooden spear with a barbed point. Then he went to the edge and looked into the swirling current. He soon realised that he had wasted his time. The current was so full of silt that he could not see 1 inch into its depths. A heavy squall came up, and Hal was promptly drenched to the skin. He didn't mind that, but after the rain came a strong wind, with nothing to stop it sweep across the great river, here 8 or 9 miles wide. Hal began to shake in his wet clothes and long for the shelter of the forest. It was hard to believe that he was within 4 degrees of the equator. He continued his vain quest for food until dark. As night closed, he made his brothers as comfortable as possible. Fortunately, Roger had been protected from the rain by the canvas over his hammock. Hal would have liked the cheer and warmth of a campfire, but there were 2 reasons for not making a fire. 1, the Indians might see it, and 2, the matches were on the ark. So Hal, quite forlorn and miserable, and humiliated by his failure to find food, crawled into his hammock. He was discovering how grim the Amazon can be to those who meet it unprepared. There was something a little terrifying about barging through the darkness at the mercy of a strong current. What if his hurrying half-acre should crash into a point, or a fixed island? He tried to tell himself that it was not very likely. His craft was carried by the current, and the current goes around things, not into them. A lone Indian who wanted to travel night and day, but must get some sleep, would tie his canoe to a floating island and wake up in the morning to find himself 30 miles further downstream. It suddenly struck Hal that night travel gave him one great advantage over Croc. Croc would doubtless stop and camp every night, knowing so little of the river. He would hardly sail it in the dark. Hal listened to the jungle roar. Sometimes it was far away, and he knew that they were miles from the shore. Then it would grow louder and louder as he approached a cape or a large island, and die away as he left it behind. Once, as they brushed the shore, the thundering voice of a jaguar not 50 feet away raised his hair on his scalp. He prayed fervently that the beast had not stepped out upon the floating island. The biggest scare of the night came when the island scraped over a sandbar and the tree, with its lower branches rubbing on the bottom, began to revolve like a mill wheel. Hal had visions of being neatly drowned if the branches to which the hammocks were fastened rolled under. Before this could happen, the tree was in deep water and righted itself. Hal gave up the idea of getting any sleep. He had no sooner done so than he slept, and did not wake until the sun looked in upon him. He scanned the horizon for the ark, but there was no sign of it. A faint call came from Roger. Hal climbed through the tree to his brother's hammock. Roger, half asleep, was calling for a drink. Hal put his hand on the boy's forehead. The patient seemed a little better. Roger opened his eyes. He looked about him dully for a moment. Then his eyes popped as he saw the swift river and flying shoreline. "Hey, what's going on? How did we get here? Where's the ark?" "I'm glad you're well enough to ask questions," Hal said, and told him all that had happened. Roger tried to rise but gave it up. "I'm as weak as a cat. Say, how about some breakfast?" "You really are better," said Hal with satisfaction. "But as for breakfast, I'm afraid there will be a slight delay. I'll see what I can do." He went out into his half acre, determined to make it yield of food and water. One dare not drink water straight from the river except at the risk of typhoid and dysentery. It must be boiled. How to boil water without any pan or tea kettle, and without any fire? Then he saw his tea kettle. A joint of bamboo would do the trick. He went to the clump of bamboos and selected one that would not be too hard to cut with his hunting knife. He cut it just below one ring and about 8 inches above it. With each ring was a partition, closing off the hollow interior. So Hal now had a pot 3 inches in diameter and 8 inches deep. If what he had read was true, this pot would not burn when filled with water and placed over a fire. How about the fire? The first thing to do was to gather together something that would burn. Everything that he touched was wet with last night's rain and this morning's dew. Then he thought of the tree in which they spent the night. He took off some of the seed pods, each about twice as large as a walnut. He broke open the shells and found plenty of dry, fluffy cotton, the kapok used for mattresses. This would do nicely as tinder. Then he cut through the wet bark of the tree. Sure enough, the inside layers were dry. There was a plentiful supply of this material, and he piled all he could use upon the tinder. Now he needed only flint and steel, and he could make a fire. The blade of his knife was steel, but he had no flint. Stone might do. He searched his half acre but found not a single stone. The truth is that stones are almost non-existent in the Amazon floodplain, so the flint and steel idea was no good. Well, he would use the fire thong method. Primitive man had made fire that way, so could he. He found a dry rattan that would do as a thong. He planted a stick slantwise in the ground, slit the end of it, put a little tinder into the slit, and then set to work drawing the thong rapidly back and forth in contact with the tinder. The friction should make the tinder break into flame. It didn't. In the South Seas, where he hoped to go, the islanders used the fire plough. A groove was made.